I know that there was at least one and probably two statements that Bill Allen had made that we had a right to that we didn't get.
Former lawmakers Pete Cott and Vic Coring will be released from prison. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 4th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a federal judge refuses to stop a one halibut limit for charters.
This battle is not going away. The sad part is for Southeast Alaska, especially in this down economic time, this is adding insult to injury.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. In today's competitive business climate, the advantage lies in reducing cost and increasing efficiencies. A safe and healthy workplace reduces cost and improves productivity. To get started, contact the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Occupational Safety and Health Consultation and Training Program at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Pete Cott and Vic Coring are going to be released from prison. The Attorney General has decided that prosecutors held back important evidence from their attorneys when they were tried and convicted on corruption charges in 2007. The U.S. Department of Justice today asked for the release of the two on their own recognizance. Attorney General Eric Holder asked the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to remand the cases back to the district court. Coring and Cott, both former Republican state legislators, were convicted of taking bribes from now-defunct oilfield services company Vico Incorporated and its owner Bill Allen in exchange for influencing the progress of a bill that changed the way oil companies in Alaska are taxed. Holder's action follows his own dropping of charges against former U.S. Senator Ted Stevens for similar reasons. At that time, Holder asked for a probe of prosecution conduct in all of the Alaska corruption cases. Today, Holder released a statement saying, quote, "It appears the department did not provide information that should have been disclosed to the defense." Coring, Seattle-based attorney John Henry Brown said he was the first person to find out after receiving a call from the Justice Department attorney who is reviewing the Alaska corruption trials. He says Stevens' lawyers had already sent him material the prosecution had withheld from him that would have been helpful in Coring's defense.
I had written a letter to Eric Holder, the attorney general, about a month ago saying I had obtained two documents from Senator Stevens' attorney that were not turned over to me in the Coring trial, and attached those to the letter to Attorney General Holder, saying that I should have been provided those, and my guess is there's more, and please consider these in your investigation, and consider releasing Mr. Coring pending the conclusion of your investigation. I was called today saying they have found additional documents in addition to the two I found that should have been provided to us. And they were going to send them to me under seal. In other words, I can't talk about them right now. And that they were going to agree to release Mr. Coring.
Brown says the documents he received from Ted Stevens' attorney were two interviews that occurred long before the Coring trial. He says the first was an FBI report and lengthy notes of one of the first interviews with Bill Allen.
And they start asking him questions about Vic Coring. In other words, Mr. Allen didn't bring up Vic Coring. And Mr. Allen's response to the questions was, Mr. Coring is just a nice guy, poor guy, sleeps on his couch, doesn't have any money, and I gave him money just to help him out from time to time because I liked him. And they then led him into saying things about Mr. Coring. Obviously, that would have been very helpful to us at the trial.
Brown says he hasn't yet talked to Vic Coring, but his staff has. Brown says Coring should be released within the next few days, and the next step will be a hearing before Anchorage Judge Sedgwick, although Brown says he will continue as in the past to ask for Sedgwick to remove himself, citing Sedgwick's wife's animosity toward Coring during her tenure as a state employee, and also because the Sedgwicks are neighbors of Bill Allen. Brown says whether Sedgwick stays on the case or not, it's unlikely that a judge would send Coring back to prison.
The only questions a fair judge should ask at that point is, were these materials helpful to the defense and they were not turned over, and that should be prosecution misconduct and case should be dismissed, just like Judge Sullivan did in Stevens.
The attorney who defended Pete Kott said he was ecstatic when he heard about Attorney General Holder's decision. Another attorney has been filing Kott's appeals, but Jim Wendt was the one who conducted the bitter 2007 court battle over a tangle of evidence involving whether excessive payment for a flooring job, political polls, and the promise of a job constituted bribes from key witness Bill Allen. Wendt says today that he always thought his client got a raw deal.
Ecstatic that he's being released. I like Pete Kott. I think he's a good guy. And while he's not perfect, I never thought that he was guilty of bribery. I certainly never thought that he was guilty of extortion.
During the trial, Wendt repeatedly complained to Judge Sedgwick that the federal prosecution team was not sharing information with him. He says that government prosecutors made similar accusations about him, but now the truth is out.
There were issues with discovery. There were a lot of complaints that the government had about me providing discovery, which why it's so ironic that it turns out that they didn't provide discovery to us. I know that there was at least one and probably two statements that that Bill Allen had made that we had a right to that we didn't get. And that was very, very troublesome when I learned about that.
Wendt lays the blame for the corruption trial on higher-ups in the Justice Department rather than the prosecutors he opposed.
I tend to think that there was some inadequate supervision. I felt that the individuals trying the case for the government did not have the depth of experience to enable them to make wise decisions. And had they had greater supervision over what they were doing, perhaps this would not have occurred.
Governor Palin is traveling out of the state, but released a statement saying she was wildly curious about what happened at DOJ during the trials. Palin went on to say that she agreed with Eric Holder about that the cases should be about justice, not winning cases, but she says she will withhold further comment until more information is released. The conviction of former U.S. Senator Ted Stevens was reversed last April after similar findings by Eric Holder. An internal probe of the way the Alaska corruption cases were handled is ongoing. Stevens was accused of lying about gifts from Allen, Vico, and others. A federal judge in Washington has refused to stop a one-fish limit for halibut charter clients in Southeast Alaska from going into effect. Judge Rosemary Collier denied an injunction today sought by charter companies to put off tomorrow's rule change. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
Charter clients now face a one halibut a day rule rather than the two that's been the recent standard. Judge Collier ruled the Commerce Department did go through the proper process of considering the effects, including the likelihood that charter operators will lose business. Collier says Commerce Secretary Gary Locke weighed the benefits and harms before making his decision. Last year, the same judge did issue an injunction that stopped a similar rule from going into effect, in part because the Commerce Department had not weighed the potential harm it could do. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration then withdrew the regulation and reissued it again this year after going through that process. NOAA Acting Deputy Alaska Regional Administrator John Kurland says they're trying to get the halibut take within the guideline harvest level.
The one fish bag limit isn't meant to be a panacea. It's you know, we recognize that it is creating some hardships for folks, but it's intended to keep us at that level while we develop that longer-term solution.
The Halibut Coalition, an organization of commercial halibut fishermen and processors, supported the decision. Their attorney is George Menina.
The court concluded that this was a legitimate fishery management objective, and the secretary had adequately and fully explained the basis for approving this allocation.
Federal officials say halibut stocks are down, and they've cut commercial fishermen's share of the catch. At the same time, charter operators have exceeded their limits, and Menina says it's the commercial fishermen who've been around longer.
In several court decisions, including several cited by the plaintiffs, if a new user group is disrupting traditional user groups' access to the resource, then regulating the new user group, even to the point of closing them out of the fishery, is permissible.
But attorneys for the charter operators argued that the Commerce Secretary has not justified why the charter companies should be pinched. Charter Halibut Task Force lawyer Earl Comstock says his clients are not to blame when the allocation numbers go down.
The commercial fishermen want something that, frankly, is impossible, which is they want their quota protected at all costs. And unless population significantly declines in the United States and the rest of the world, which doesn't seem likely, there is going to be an increasing demand for recreational fish. So this battle is not going away. The sad part is for Southeast Alaska, especially in this down economic time, this is adding insult to injury and, you know, over, as I said, a very small amount of fish.
Even as the one fish a day rule goes into effect, the battle isn't over. Judge Collier says the charter operators can go forward with a lawsuit challenging the rule based on its merits. Meanwhile, NOAA has issued a proposal for an overall limited access system. The comment period on that closes Friday. NOAA's John Kurland hopes it works out some of the conflict between the charter operators and the commercial fishermen.
What we're really trying to do is move towards a long-term solution, which is a limited access system with catch shares between the charter halibut fishery and the commercial halibut fishery, so that overall everyone participating in those fisheries can work together to keep the overall catch within sustainable levels and help conserve the stock.
Judge Collier noted that moving forward on an overall limited access system may change the battle over halibut, and she gave the plaintiffs the option of waiting to return to court until that's hammered out. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services is reporting two new positive test results for the H1N1, or so-called swine flu, in Alaska. The samples were confirmed yesterday. One patient is a boy from Haines. He first reported feeling ill on May 27th after returning from a trip to Seattle. He has since recovered, and no one among his family or friends has reported any flu-like illness. The other patient is an adult male in his 20s from Fairbanks who first reported feeling ill on May 30th. No information is currently available on where or how he may have been infected. There is no known connection between these two cases and the first case reported in Fairbanks on May 28th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new management plan for the Hatcher Pass area.
We've been noticing a rapid increase in use, and we've been noticing too that the increase has derived not just from the Manitou Valley, but also from the Anchorage area.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. The H1N1 swine flu has reached Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water, or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands, and stay home if you're sick, and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
The Matanuska Valley's Hatcher Pass is popular with winter snow machiners and summertime hikers. Growing use by recreational-minded Alaskans is prompting the State Department of Natural Resources to update a management plan for the greater Hatcher Pass area. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Gold seekers once climbed its steep mountains searching for the motherlode, and their rough wagon trail, now a two-lane blacktop, is about the most direct route to historic Hatcher Pass. For decades, the old gold mine there has drawn tourists, and skiers and snow machiners flock to its hillsides in winter months for fun in the snow. A few too many snow machiners, in fact, and that's why the state wants to take another look at the Hatcher Pass Land Use Management Plan.
This map is the Hatcher Pass Management Plan area.
Bruce Phelps is a section chief with the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. He's got a map spread out across his desk, a huge map at that, with the area's geography detailed in a spectrum of colors.
It's essentially an area that extends on the east from the Moose Range up to essentially the Keshwitna River, which is the northern boundary area, and then west to and including what is known as the Willow Mountain critical habitat area and south to essentially private land that's inside the borough.
The area covers some 25,000 acres. He says snow machiners have used the area for three decades, but now patterns of use have changed.
One of the things that we have been noticing is a rough doubling of activity or usage patterns like once every two or three years. This is during the winter. That's when we have our peak use period. And so we've been noticing a rapid increase in use, and we've been noticing, too, that the increase has derived not just from the Madawaska Valley, but also from the Anchorage area. So there are a lot of people from Anchorage that use this area both in the winter as well as the summer.
And snow machine innovations are a concern.
They now have a type of unit that can go up to the top of a mountain, for example, and then they ski down, but they release the vehicle and the vehicle comes down on its own motive power without any sort of intervention. So they're skiing down and the vehicle's going down by itself, and that's in the same area oftentimes where you have skiers.
So a robot snow machine on the loose could do some damage to other users. Phelps says the original management plan was written in 1986 with clearly defined motorized and non-motorized use areas. Mountaineering and paragliding, even sled dog mushing, are on the increase now, too, and non-motorized and motorized designations may need a new look. The Matanuska Sioux Sitna Borough has some plans of its own for Hatcher Pass. The borough has an in-holding within the greater state-owned land area, and the borough plans to build a regional ski area for Nordic and Alpine skiers. A draft EIS for that project is in the works now, scheduled for public review next year. According to the borough's timeline, a final EIS should be ready by the end of 2010, and construction is slated to begin the summer of 2011. Phelps says the state and borough plans need to be consistent. Rob Wells sits on the borough assembly.
I don't see any inconsistencies. At this point, the management plan as it was developed in the mid-80s certainly can stand a review after 20 years, but I don't see conflict between what the state's doing and what the borough has planned for.
Phelps says the historic and culturally significant areas within Hatcher Pass are well-defined, but moose habitat is undergoing some changes, and that needs to be considered, too. Phelps says the public can get involved by sending DNR comments on recreational use or desired changes in motor or non-motor use by June 5th. The state's Hatcher Pass Area Management Plan should be ready for review early next year. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
NOAA fishery scientists are using a new method for surveying the southern edge of the Bering Sea ice pack for seals as they both move north. A remote-controlled pilotless drone is being flown off the deck of the NOAA research vessel MacArthur II. The ship was recently in Kodiak before heading to the Bering Sea and launching the Scan Eagle, a 40-pound drone with a 10-foot wingspan. It's not unlike the surveillance drones being used by the military in the Middle East. Peter Boving, the leader for the Polar Ecosystem Program at National Marine Mammal Laboratory in Seattle, says the price of remote-controlled drones has fallen.
I'd say the capabilities for doing some of this work have spun off or been enhanced by the military interest and funding that has enabled small companies to produce some of these unmanned aircraft at price points that become approachable for civilian agencies and others to use for research. And our interest in using it for marine mammals stemmed from the fact that we're often forced to try to survey these animals in very remote places that are at the very least expensive to get to and often also risky for our observers to get to.
The Scan Eagle is owned and operated by the University of Alaska and was built by a subsidiary of Boeing. Both NOAA and the university's Institute for Arctic Research will use the still and video images taken by the Scan Eagle during a month-long test to determine if drones can be used to estimate the number and location of spotted, bearded, and ringed seals on the ice pack. Robin Anglis, the deputy director of the National Marine Mammal Laboratory, says there are a number of missions for which NOAA could use drones like the Scan Eagle.
Just from a broader perspective, perspective, NOAA in general is keenly interested in using unmanned aircraft for a wide variety of civilian purposes, from monitoring sea ice to studying hurricanes to, you know, studying ghost nets in the Hawaiian Islands. NOAA has had a program, the NOAA UAS program, for a couple of years now that has been facilitating these kinds of civilian projects.
Inglis says the same technology could be used in fisheries enforcement, keeping an unblinking eye on the fishing grounds. The cost of the drone itself is about $40,000. The Scan Eagle can fly for about 20 hours on 2 gallons of fuel at up to 75 miles per hour after being launched by a pneumatic catapult. To land, hooks on the drone's wings catch a line hung from a crane aboard the MacArthur II. The data gathered this month will help NOAA to understand seal habitat better and gauge their sensitivity to climate change. An environmental group says it will sue the federal government to force a decision on additional protections for Arctic seals. The Center for Biological Diversity says the Obama administration missed a deadline required by law for an endangered species listing decision on ringed, bearded, and spotted seals. A 60-day notification letter is required before a lawsuit can be filed. The group in May of 2008 petitioned to protect the Arctic seals because of threats to their sea ice habitat from global warming and petroleum development. In September, the agency found that the three seal species may deserve Endangered Species Act protection.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The State Department of Transportation will be taking a step back in time with road maintenance this winter to salt. DOT crews will no longer use magnesium chloride to melt snow and ice on roads the department maintains in 4 communities. State-maintained roads in Juneau, Sitka, Valdez, and Fairbanks will be cleared with a 23% brine of salt and water. DOT spokesman Roger Weatherall says the change comes about because of the cost of other chemical de-icers.
We have determined that this is a great opportunity for us to save state money. And not only that, but it will allow us to be less frugal with the amount of dispersant that we use on the roads. And that will allow us to provide for safer travel for people on Alaska's roads, because we'll be able to disperse more of the salt brine than we could with the magnesium chloride.
As a comparison, Weatherall says the salt brine will cost about 20 cents a gallon, while magnesium chloride now costs between $1.40 and $2 per gallon. The scientific and engineering communities, as well as automotive sources, present conflicting arguments on the use of salt versus magnesium chloride. Recent studies show that salt is more corrosive on roads and bridges and on older automobiles. However, other studies show that materials and construction methods have improved enough to counter any negative reactions on newer infrastructure and personal property. Weatherall says the department has considered those factors in making its decision.
Through the research that's been done, we're very comfortable. You know, we have a very distinct comfort level as to low expectations of any corrosion. You know, with the mixture in the salt brine being, you know, upwards of 80% water, we don't really feel that it will, you know, increase the level of corrosion.
Weatherall says the department will decide during the winter whether to expand the practice to other communities. The prolonged warm, dry weather enjoyed by Southeast Alaskans so far this summer comes with a price: increased fire danger in the Tongass. The typically damp environment can dry out quickly when temperatures move into the 60s and 70s. Land managers are braced for what could be another busy fire season in the rainforest. From KCAW in Sitka, Robert Woolsey reports.
Mary Emmerich is the fire response coordinator for the Sitka Ranger District. Fires in Southeast tend to be smaller than the headline wildfires elsewhere, But the fact that there are fires at all here is surprising. It comes down to a few weeks of warm weather.
In the summer of 2004, some people might remember that summer was much like this one. We actually went to 15 fires on this district. Now, a lot of them are just really small escape campfires, but there have been fires in other areas. Say, in Hoonoe, we actually had a 300-acre fire a few years ago that actually had large flame lengths, and there were evacuations.
There are a couple of big differences between the classic forest fire that everyone thinks of, a raging crown fire in the treetops or a wind-driven grass fire. Many of those fires are caused by lightning. Fires in Southeast burn and spread below ground, and they are almost certainly caused by someone who has not been careful with a campfire.
We have such a deep duff layer that these little embers will work their way down, and the fire will actually go underground, and you might not even see it for a few days. I've been to fires here where it's raining, and underneath the trees you have flames. What people need to do is just really make sure that their fires are out when they leave them.
Emmerich says the beach is the best location for a campfire this year if you're not at a cabin or other established site with a fire ring. In both cases, the fire should be doused with water, either by the incoming tide or by the camper. The last and maybe most significant difference between fires in the Tongass and fires elsewhere is that fire is not a part of the rainforest ecology. At times in Alaska's interior, there are more acres burning than in the rest of the country combined. Unless these fires threaten property or other resources, they may be allowed to burn. The same is true in the lower 48, where the lodgepole pine forests are serotonous. Their cones actually require fire to open. Emmerich says Tongass fires can be ecologically devastating.
Here, actually, fire is damaging to the ecosystem. It can actually take the place back to primary succession. There's some examples of that over in Hannah's Bay, where there's some islands that actually have no vegetation on them at all anymore because of wildfire.
Just under 2 inches of rain fell in Sitka in the month of May, less than half of normal precipitation for the month. Fire danger, Emmerich says, will remain high even with the occasional rainy day. She says it will take a real soaker, about 3 days of steady rain, to return the area to its relatively fire-free condition. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
State forest fire officials have pulled back crews from the Broken Snowshoe wildfire near McGrath. The fire is mostly out, and remaining firefighters are mopping up hot spots. 7 crews, their equipment, and 2 helicopters were sent home yesterday. A lightning strike on May 24th was blamed for the fire that eventually covered 25,000 acres, or 39 square miles, north of McGrath. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Susanna Caldwell. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free quitline counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. 1-888-842-7848.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.